Hello, everyone, and welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, your podcast about board gaming. I'm here with my good friend Michael Walker. Walker, what'd you do this weekend?
I went to a gaming convention.
That sounds like a waste of time.
You might have heard of it.
No.
It was the SwagCon. It's this podcast that you might have heard of.
Yes.
They had a convention.
Congrès, So Very Wrong About Games, Fun Times, Good Vibes Only, Trans Rights or Human Rights Board Game Jamboree was this weekend. And indeed, that is going to be the topic of this week's discussion. We are going to give you all that our failing voices can provide, and we'll give you a kind of a post-con report.
Yeah, we might have explained a dozen or two games over the weekend.
Yes, there was a lot of rules explanations going on, and the con environment was conducive to conversation, but nonetheless taxing on the vocal cords. But anyway, we are going to give you a full episode of So Very Wrong About Games this week because we are gluttons for punishment and we have the relentlessness of a deranged chihuahua. So we're going to talk about the game we reviewed last year in our as-yet-unnamed retrospective intro segment. We're going to talk about some of a very small subsection of the games we played last week. We're going to talk about the news and why it doesn't matter, and then we're going to talk about our topic, which is the SwagCon report. So, Walker.
Mark.
What did we review last year?
Mark, exactly 1 year ago, we reviewed a very colorful psychedelic game called Aboria. This was an interesting, like, sort of water slide, double water slide, because all your workers sort of slid vertically, and then they slid horizontally.
A lot of sliding.
A lot of sliding. It's very interesting. I do want to get back to it. I have kept it, because it has stuff there. It's very interesting. It's very colorful.
It is neat. So, I was thinking about this. So, first of all, this is by Danny Garcia. I think this is Danny Garcia's best work that we've played. Barcelona was fine, but Arboria, I think, by virtue of the timing elements, it's a little bit like Tsulkin in that the workers get better as they age, as they season, as they ferment. But it feels different from Tsulkin by virtue of the way that the worker sliding goes down. It's really quite cool. Arboria is one of those Euros in a heavy hobbyist rotation where it's like, yeah, Arboria was definitely, it was good, it was good. Yeah, but not quite. This is the new hotness, we should play it. Or, yeah, this is one of the all-time good Euros of the past five years or so. You know, the category that we would put Oak in, probably the category we'd put Autobahn in, right? The ones that you remember sufficiently vividly and like enough. So what I'm saying is, this is damning with faint praise. I would happily play Arboria again. But I think there's a reason why we haven't quite gotten there.
Well, it's definitely one of those games that you can't just bring out and the rules come back to you.
That's part
there
of the problem,
yes. There is a lot going on in Arboria. It's like even now, just trying to remember it, there's this whole phase of unlocking
yes.
creatures, and then they sort of go into a pen, and then you get them from the pen, and then they go somewhere else.
Yes.
And, oh my God, now it's all coming back to me now. It's this vivid psychedelic dream, and you're also making this sort of garden on the side where you're like matching colors.
Right. Yes. Yeah, that was the one scoring element too many that I could never quite get. But you got the animals because they served as a multiplier for some of the scoring bit. But then there was the pattern creation, which at that point I tune out of the scoring explanation.
This is all on top of the sliding workers.
Mostly it's the sliding that I like.
And populating those slides with druids as well on the side that will make
yes.
actions better.
Yes.
Josh.
Yeah, you know, the action selection, I remember being sufficiently interesting and novel, where it's like, yeah, Arboria, that was pretty good. But perhaps it was the rules complication. Perhaps it's, again, you know, not quite top tier. So maybe if we have a bit of a lull, whenever that happens, we'll be able to spend the necessary 15 to 20 minutes brushing up on the rules and getting it back to the table. But look, if you got a chance to play Arboria, especially if someone else is teaching, I'd jump on it. It's pretty cool.
Yep.
So maybe more on Arboria later. And now let's move on to some of the games we played last week, because quite frankly, I stopped taking notes because there were just too many,
I took,
which is a good problem to have.
I took notes, and then when I was putting all the information in, I remembered
more
games that I forgot to write down for some reason.
So these are some of the highlights that we want to pay attention to. So Walker, what are some of the games that you played last week?
Mark, we set up Phantom Division, and I left it set up so people could easily play it. And some people got the feeling of what it takes to set up Phantom Division. So
yes.
It's not nothing. Lots of walls and things to put up and
Which is strange. It's strange you say that now, because I remember the first time we talked about Phantom Division, I said, oh yeah, and Setup is a killer, as well as Teardown. You're like, yeah, it wasn't that bad.
It's because I always set it up by myself.
Sure.
So when you're setting it by yourself, there's not these people sitting around you watching what you're doing.
And making you internalize the time ticking by.
Yeah, so you don't get this feeling of there are people waiting
right
to play while I'm doing this. Like, you're sitting there, you're enjoying it. You're like, you're creating this cool map, and when you're by yourself, it's fine, but when there's people standing, sitting there waiting to play a game,
that's such a good observation. You have a couple sets of eyes on you, and you get the sense that you're wasting everyone's time, and that you're giving them this huge opportunity cost. But meanwhile, if you're just by yourself, maybe it takes 20 minutes, maybe it takes 45, whatever. It's your time to spend.
Yeah, because it's like Phantom Division. We're playing this flicking game where we're going to shoot stuff. So you know the expectation, the fun levels. High,
yes.
and then you start building them up,
and
you're watching it tick down, right? And you want it to stay high. You want them to enjoy this thing, but now it's like, okay, now we have to put out all these turrets. Now we have to put out all the crates. And now we have to put the certain doors in, and yeah, it's
so you set it up on the neoprene mat. You left the walls set up, not the crates and the turrets and all the specific the objective tokens. They went back into the box, but you left it set up on your amazing Lazy Susan. Which, frankly, when and if there's ever more crowdfunding for Phantom Division, I think needs to be... You need to partner with somebody who makes Lazy Susan. It's got to be an available stretch goal.
That's
look,
right.
If Kabuto Sumo can have Lazy Susan-style wooden rings, I think Phantom Division can have its own Lazy Susan. But anyway, after crossing that hurdle, what was your experience with Phantom Division?
I believe everyone very much enjoyed it. I took out my amazing shotgun again and used the proper discs this time.
Yes.
And I am going to go back. I don't think it worked as well as I thought. Because we saw how when I did the larger discs, they did sometimes jump walls and stuff.
Yes.
The smaller ones did that tenfold.
Oh.
So sometimes it was a little harder. And then because they were so small, it made it, I don't want to say they're tiny, smaller than the other ones that we used.
They're awfully small, yes.
So sometimes, and lighter, so therefore sometimes it was harder to see whether
to see
they
what
hit,
did it hit
and it hit because the larger ones dislodged stuff that it hit. Smaller ones did not do that. So, but that being said, it wasn't that big a deal. I want to make it out that it was something big, but
yeah,
I will always love Phantom Division, and teaching it, I think the teach is getting better because you need to just explain to the people that this is just a flicking game. I shouldn't say that.
Just a flicking
game. Yeah, I know.
Walker.
I'm very
How
sorry.
How dare you?
I'm very sorry.
How dare you? Phantoms died for our liberty, Walker.
It's true.
I think. It's all been redacted.
This is a very fun flicking game. And you can do almost anything that you want to do. There's a rule set around it for passing stuff around, for moving around, shooting around corners. You get to do everything you want to do in this game. But essentially, it is a flicking game with a rule set around, like just sort of containing what you can do. You know what I mean? You're going to be moving around. You're going to be flicking. And then there are rules around to tell you, you know, how to do that. So just understand that that's where it is. You're going to have fun doing that.
Moving
forward.
Yeah, I'd be interested to see how that particular explanation went in practice. So I had a very different experience at the con in that you had left the board set up. People wanted to play Phantom Division. There was a lot of pent-up demand. But learning it from the rule book at a con is not exactly a thing that can be done, especially since, as it stands, the rules are in rough shape. Because, as a reminder, this is a production copy that we have from the publisher. We're actually going to be sending it back so they can show it off at Gen Con. And the rules are in rough shape. They say they're working on them. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, but even the ones we have are already, like, They have iterations after the one after the book.
We don't have the latest version printed out, and even with the latest version, there's still some blind spots. But I was concerned about what setup there was left to be done, and I was concerned about the rules explanation. And both concerns proved to be unfounded, because what happened was I took out the scenario. I noticed that the scenario that I randomly picked required subtle modifications to the map from what you had constructed. That took barely a minute. And then when it came time to setting out the crates, setting out the turrets, setting out the objective tokens, I was able, even with the Lazy Susan, to just lay the scenario flat on the table, hand someone a bag, and say, randomize these and put them where it says on the map. Hand someone else a bag. This is the supply. Put them all on a cloth bag. Randomize them on these positions. And classic example of many hands make for light work. The entire setup took barely any time at all. I dare say even... It took less setup than your average lightweight Euro, frankly, with that proviso. Granted, as I said, the map was mostly constructed for me. And then the rules explanation went fine because, broadly speaking, when one person has internalized the AI cold, then the rules that the other players need to understand in detail are very minimal. And I guess that having phrased it thus, I can kind of understand where you're coming from in the sense that you can do more, you know, you have the rough parameters of what you're able to do, go to town, and then people are like, okay, well, where is this enemy going to go? It's like, they're going to move towards the noise so they can either move to this space or that space. Okay. And with that in mind, allow me to emphasize that I really think that Phantom Division, building upon the strength of SEAL Team Flicks, it does stealth so very, very, very well. Where they're going to go, what can draw their attention, when you're in serious danger, how to hide, when to go loud, when to be quiet, is so exceptionally well done in Phantom Division. And that is, at the end of the day, what appeals to me as much as the hybridization of tactical gameplay and flicking. We had in our game a shotgun operator that we were just operating. I did not import my overpowered SEAL into this particular scenario, unlike Walker, who desperately is attached to that shotgun.
No, well, it wasn't just that. It was because
you always want your toy. That's fine.
It was solely because we had flicked the wrong size discs. And so
Fair enough. Oh, yeah. So your journalistic integrity mandated that in this intro con game, you bring in your leveled up SEAL.
You nailed it.
Got it. And our shotgun operator wasn't quite the surgeon that you were. What he was a battering ram, because what they were able to do was, with remarkable accuracy, have both pellets hit the same target. We had a particular problem whereby we kept getting enforcers at problematic instances. It's like, I don't know how much firepower we're able to put down on him. And the shotgunner would just show up and just murder them with one shot. It was amazing.
Nice.
Because with those super tiny discs, it's rough. They're gonna scatter all over the place, even independently of the fact that they're stacked physically on top of each other. But no, they went straight right where they wanted them and managed to do it with a great deal of success. I will say that the easy difficulty level now, for me, I think is too easy. I think next time we play, we're going to go straight to hard, even if some of the players are new, because I think easy gives you too many rounds, too few adversaries. I'd like to see what the higher difficulty levels are. We had a cakewalk. It was incredibly easy to get through.
No mercury bombs? Unfortunately, we had mercury bombs.
You had mercury bombs. Okay, well, yes, we didn't have any mercury bombs. What we did have, though, on the topic of bombs was we had a little bit of miscalibration between positioning and mission objectives. One of our mission objectives was to destroy a fixed installation with a remote detonated bomb. The person who took the remote detonated bomb got bogged down and was separated. Basically, two or three phantoms went on ahead, and basically there was a wall of enemies between us and the person with the bomb. So when we found the thing that needed to be blown up by the bomb was way off on the other side of the map. However, what happened was that Phantom had a spare action at one point, and I mentioned casually, well, the bomb does have two uses. You only need to save one for the objective. You could, with that extra action, just drop the bomb in the zone. They did. Two turns later, there were three enemies in that zone, and we had already left. And the person with the bomb started looking at that area. I'm like, you know, you could detonate that bomb as a free action, and sure enough, bang. So that was great. But yes, the game would have been considerably more difficult if we had had to deal with the mercury bombs. I'm curious about what they're going to do with that.
And that is Phantom Division, designed by Pete Ruth and Mark Thomas, put out by Phantom Horizon.
Scheduled for release in 2026 after successful crowdfunding, but of course, when it comes to crowdfunding fulfillment, we'll believe it when we see it.
I feel as though there was a concession made there, that Pete wanted the game called Phantom Horizon, Mark wanted it Phantom Division, and there was some sort of okay, we'll call the company Phantom Horizon, but we'll call the game Phantom Division.
Who knows? I got to play Westphalia. I've been wanting to play Westphalia ever since it was released. Westphalia is designed by Emma Holland, published by Holland Spiel in 2019. It is a 6-player only historical negotiation game about the 17th century negotiations surrounding the Treaty of Westphalia.
I can't believe you didn't invite me to this, because this sounds like it's right up my alley.
Walker, the more you make fun of the setting of this game, the deeper your ignorance is revealed.
Okay.
Are you even familiar with the term Westphalian states? Do you know what happened in the 30 Years' War? Do you know the reverberations of this?
That has something to do with the Kardashians, I'm sure.
Oh my goodness, Walker. So, one of the things that's really striking about Westphalia as a product, I highly recommend anyone who even has the remotest interest in the period to read the first half of the rulebook, because it's all just historical table setting. And I love Amabel Holland's voice, because it's very well researched, very knowledgeable of the historical period, and at the same time, incredibly sarcastic and sardonic, because the end of the 30 Years' War was a shambolic mess. Everyone was exhausted. It was one of those things where everyone knew what they were doing is stupid. Those that had lost knew they had lost years ago. Those that kind of sort of won, no one really won the 30 Years' War. Those that had kind of sort of won already had what they needed. And everyone was just delaying the inevitable because they didn't want to be desperately embarrassed. And sometimes, when I see, I could call out specific events during my lifetime, but sometimes it's important to forget that people do things that are against their self-interest just because they don't want to admit that they were, you know, bluffing with a 2 and a 3 the entire time, to pull out a poker metaphor. But anyway, so I've been wanting to play Westphalia for a very, very long time, but exactly 6 players want to play a historical negotiation game. A lot of people don't want to play historical games. A lot of people don't want to play negotiation games. It's not super long. It's about 2 hours or so. So it's not a huge lift in that sense. But it's so fragile for player count and interest. So I had the opportunity. They had 5. They were looking for a 6. I'm like, the stars have aligned. And I got to play Westphalia at SwagCon, and it was legit glorious. It was a fabulous experience. The person who was teaching the game did such an incredible job at setting the stage. Some of the details got lost, but quite frankly, one of the other problems of playing Westphalia is that in classic Amabel Holland fashion, yeah, the rules are only about 6 to 8 pages long, but they're full of tiny, little, thorny details that are super easy to forget and almost impossible to convey in a rules explanation, and almost impossible to retain. That having been said, the person who guided us through did a splendid job. Because again, it's a lot about the tone, it's a lot about the theme, it's a lot about understanding what each historical power wanted to get out of the situation and the particular burdens and overall context of what was going on. Because there's so much, one of the reasons why the 30 Years' War was so complicated was so many different powers were involved and their goals were all so weird. Like just as an example, and I think it's a good one, I was playing as France. France has some client states that each have their own fights to fight. The Dutch have a revolt against Spain, and the Swedish want to retain and expand and get back some past stuff that they lost to the Austro-Hungarians. And the Swedes also really, really care about the spread of Protestantism and the entrenchment of the rights of Protestant rulers in an environment that was sometimes hostile to non-Catholic forces. France, at the time, was heavily Catholic. And so there's this bizarre combination of interests that are so strange and weird. But it was not entirely unlike, and this will make far more sense to an American audience, not entirely unlike the fact that the American Revolution was largely bankrolled by the French. The French monarchy, mind you. So you would end up with the situation like, so you as the French king are funding this anti-monarchical revolution. It's like, yeah, but it'll hurt someone I don't like. It's like, sure, this won't blow up in your face ever at all, I'm sure. Anyway, there was this one moment that I have to mention, just because one of the players at the table playing the Dutch pulled off probably the greatest gaming move I've seen in years. Another problem with Westphalia is that at the end of the game, there is a multi-part resolution system to determine what your score actually is. And none of us really understood how it worked, even after we had done it. It's over a dozen steps, and it involves at least several steps for each player. But the player playing the Dutch figured out that at the end of the game, if the French and the Dutch collectively controlled as much in one of the 2 theaters of war. Did I mention that France was fighting in 2 theaters of war? It's wild. As much as the Spanish, then the French get a huge benefit. So, the Dutch player looks at their standing. They'd been doing very, very well. And they're like, okay, Spain, you desperately want to make peace because Spain is in no business fighting a war. They can't afford it. Nobody can afford it, but the Spanish desperately can't afford it. So the Spanish are asking for peace. Rounds one and two, the Dutch boy says, nah, I'm not quite ready yet. I don't think you've suffered quite enough, was the undertone. And so finally, as it was on the map, here we are. Okay, fine. Let's make peace. And I shrug and I say, look, that's not great for me because now I'm fighting the Spanish alone over there. If the Dutch and the Spanish are allied, then the Spanish only have to come after me. And so now suddenly I have to worry about two fronts and one of my allies is gone. That's not great, but we'll see what happens. And then the Dutch player looks over and says, you know, you could just give me that territory you have in the Netherlands. I'm like, why would I do that? It's like, well, I'm at peace with Spain. And if at the end of the game we collectively have the territory, you get the bonus. If you have it, he can take it from you. If I have it, he can't. Like, so I stand there slack-jawed and stunned for a solid 10 seconds, processing the evil genius of this individual who had just cut a peace treaty and now was knifing their partner with such ferocity and with such a pleasant smile on their face.
Just had a boot in your throat, that's all.
It was amazing. The reaction of the Spanish player a couple minutes later when they realized what had happened just as they were gearing up for their great campaign to wipe the French out of the Netherlands and reestablish their homeland, it was delicious and amazing. I cannot tell you how fantastic it was. There were tons of interesting little moments of tough negotiations, of everyone thinking, well, I can't really afford to do this. Nobody could afford to do anything. But it was really well done. It was possibly, find it difficult to imagine a better context and a better execution for trying this game. Balanced? Oh, no. Again, this is about, you know, the historicity, it was almost a borderline LARPing experience in terms of historical war games. We realized at the end of the game that the Austro-Hungarian player gets we knew this at the start, they get a random victory condition card that tells them the parameters so that the victory conditions aren't all perfectly transparent. And we looked at what the Austro-Hungarian player needed to do in order to win. And frankly, based on the game we just play, I struggle to think of how it would even be possible, let alone likely. It's so difficult and arbitrary. But then again, a fair number of historical war games are like that, right? Tend to be very, very, very slanted in favor of the historical victor. It's not something I enjoy, but it's something I understand. And it is also the case that a number of Hollandspiel designs and a number of games by Amabel Holland tend to be very, very fragile, very rickety, full of sharp edges and weird little nooks and crannies in chrome. But in this particular case, I don't think I would have had it any other way. So I don't know that this is the kind of thing that you can approach with a vaguely competitive mindset at all, like trying to think that, oh, this is a game where we all have a chance to win. If you want that, you should play Sidereal Confluence. That is a much, much more fair and approachable game in terms of accessing the mechanisms. But if you want something that's evocative and fascinating and occasionally moments of deliriously delicious tension and pain because you can't afford to keep fighting, but you feel you have to, Westphalia is a triumph in terms of delivering memorable gaming experiences. And so I have no regrets whatsoever. And if you go in with that mindset, well, Westphalia has my highest possible recommendation. And once again, thank you so much to everyone who was at that table. It was a glorious experience.
Got to show some people Project Elite. It won't sound as glorious as it was glorious, but it's not so decadent as a negotiation historical game. This is a mow the aliens down, real time, roll a bunch of dice, slaughter fest. And people go into it, they say, oh, we just have to go out and put some dice out on these objectives and then
and then
come back, it'll be great. And then the first turn happens and we played with five players. And when you play with five players, it just means more things spawn because they expect you with five people, you're going to be able to kill more things. So after the first spawn phase, the look of horror and fear around the table was palpable. And then, halfway through, they didn't think there was any way. And then I explained to them how you can manipulate the board state. It's like this boss that came out is going to destroy us because we can't get to it. There's no, it's doing these things that and says, no, when we roll the dice and we have to move aliens, only move that boss. Everyone move the boss, bring him to the front, and then we will mow him down. And then they understood they could see the lanes that we could funnel aliens down to, how we could manipulate, because During the real time, you have 2 minutes, you're rolling the dice, and you must, when you roll the alien symbol, you must contend with that first, which is move an alien one space. And then you get to use the other dice to, you know, attack and or move or search things. And so you can bring things to the front, cycle aliens down through certain lanes, use the people that have the good guns to clear the board. We managed to get down there. And even the objective is that, like, right near the spawn point, we got stuff on there. We took a little bit of wounds. There was a little bit of pain and suffering there. One of the players had that great ability where you could roll the dice and the two sort of search, use things could be, were wild. You can use them as anything. Unfortunately, when you roll the alien symbol, they all counted as two alien symbols.
Yes, I remember that one.
So that was interesting and painful to watch as that worked out, but it worked out great. And it was me going down the one sort of the right side of the field, all funneled down this one sort of corridor. And I was desperately trying to fight my way up that corridor, but it just didn't happen. But I guess it just worked out because I would sit at this one corner where we could get the aliens that could run past me and I wouldn't get pushed. Because when you get pushed, you take wounds. And so they'd come down and I would mow them all down. Then it would fill up again. I just couldn't advance down there, but it still worked out. Everyone went around the other side.
Oh, good. Did you win?
We did. We achieved the objective.
I wandered over after, I think, the start of the second round. You were all at the base, not having progressed very far physically, and the entire board was full of enemies. It was amazing.
That's what I'm saying. The look of horror is like, how are we possibly going to get up the field? But yeah, so you have to... We had got up the objectives, and then you have to get all the way back to the base in order to win. No one can die. Everyone must make it back by a certain number of turns. There's bosses that are spawning. There's events that you have to do. I always will love Project Elite, and I'm so glad I got to play it. This is designed by Constantinos Cornelius, Marco Portugal, and Solarios Tassalis. And the edition I have is not their tippy one. It is the Simon newer edition, and I love it.
Got to play Ankh, Gods of Egypt, which was our game of the year 2021. There are a number of reasons why con environments are amazing and a number of things that you just have to accept as being part of the con experience. One of them is that typically when you play a game, you're going to play at max player count. And sometimes that's not ideal. Like, for example, with Project Elite. Project Elite is probably not best with 5, but I think you and I would both happily play with 5. Some games you just flatly shouldn't play with max player count, and that sometimes becomes fraught in a con environment.
Which is kind of funny, because I totally forgot, like, I had sat down with 4 people and were ready to play it, and someone came along and said it was full, and then I just sort of had to think for a minute. It's like,
you
can play this with 6. You're right, yeah, sure.
Oh, you're playing with 6?
Yes.
Oh, I thought you were playing with just 5. Oh, my goodness.
No. We were 4 to start. We did not play with 6. We played with 5, but I mean, we were 4, because I just thought it was 4, and then another person asked if there was room, and I had to think for a second. It's like, Yeah, there's pieces. And I looked at you can play up to 6. 5? Let's do 5. Sure, why not?
Oh, okay. I thought max player count was 5. I didn't know that you could go to 6 would be a trip and a half. Yes. But anyway, so we played Ankh, Gods of Egypt. We played with 5. Not my ideal player count, but I'm still happily willing to play the game. There's some games I wouldn't play at max player count flatly, and then I just have to do the awkward, kind of there's room, but go away, which I didn't have to do. And unlike most games of Ankh, Gods of Egypt, because there's a lot of ways for the game to end, I'd say prematurely, but that's kind of a misnomer. Some games end prematurely by virtue of special sudden death victory conditions. It's just Ankh, the thread of the game is typically it ends when somebody cracks the top of the victory point marker, and that tends to happen before the game would end of its own accord. You progress along an event track, and you seldom go the distance. This time we did, because there was a 2-way tie leading up into the last battle event where 2 players were 1 point shy of winning. And so it all came down to timing. And the timing was determined by something that I'd never seen before in a game of Ankh, but which happened twice in this game of Ankh, which is a province becoming entirely full. There was literally no room for anything. The first time that it happened was somewhat in the middle of the game where 3 players in the same battle played Build Monument. So we all built monuments. I would say all, but the last player couldn't build a monument. There wasn't any room left. There was literally no geography available, and so they just happened to get the short end of the stick. Similarly, I was one of the two players tied for 1 point away from victory. I'm like, okay, how's this going to go? I look at Region 1. Region 1 does me no favors. Region 2 is small, and so I'm able, with a movement action, to just flood the zone and occupy all the areas of Area 2 with my own figures. Now, there was a way for the other player to come in. Ankh is great because there's all this weird stuff that can happen, but nonetheless in a very controlled way. As we sometimes commented, it's the Eric Lang game co-designed by Rainer Knizia, even though Knizia isn't there. It feels shockingly Knizia-ish in a lot of ways. But Sobek, the crocodile, can be in water areas which no one else can, and that could have allowed that player to get into Region 2 and therefore compete for that point in terms of timing. But the scoring happened before that could be done, and so by the very skin of my teeth in terms of timing, we were able to pull it off. It was just really interesting to see that geographic limitation kick in a way that I hadn't seen in other games. Now, granted, it's more likely in a five-player game than it is in lower-player games, and the geography always matters in terms of positioning and availability. It's not uncommon for you to want to get next to something and be unable to because someone's blocked it off for you, even in a two-player game. But twice we saw provinces completely fill up, and that be very influential in terms of the resolution. A lot of new players, but everyone seemed to have a great time. I love Ankh, Gods of Egypt. My only misgiving about the game now, because I've got the Kickstarter all-in version with a couple of expansions, is I'm having increasing difficulties storing and transporting it. For a while, I've been keeping it in the Laser Ox all-in-one containment system, which is kind of okay, but it's a bit of a bear to deal with because it's actually two different organizers in one just for the base game, one for the expansion materials, and so consequently the materials are just spread out all over the place.
I was going to say, because I also did the same sort of thing, I have the scythe, right? And remember, I pretty well just hollowed out almost everything from, so I think you should keep the outside of Laser Ox and then just dump everything else that's in it and go back to the bag and just fill that thing up. And I think it'll just be faster.
You know what? You're probably right. Now, that having been said, deep in my heart of hearts, I'm convinced that somebody with a 3D printer has come up with a really, really good organizational system, because one of the reasons why I moved away from the baggies was, number one, the cardboard box situation was becoming unmanageable. And the other problem is that the miniatures are really cool, and there's a lot of spears and staves. And they're not the bendy plastic, they're the stiffer plastic. And I live in fear that something's going to snap, and I'm not going to be able to find it. So, in an ideal world, I should just spend some time on Printables and Thingiverse and see if there's anything good. Listeners, if you've encountered any good storage solutions for Ankh, please let me know. But as it is, something has got to change because, sadness of sadness, someone at the con, I don't know who, left a little note on the box that said, "The organizer has defeated us." So somebody wanted to play Ankh, tried, and couldn't. And that is sad. So clearly something needs to be done.
That is very sad, actually.
It is very sad. That having been said, again, huge fan of Ankh, Gods of Egypt. Don't play it nearly as much as I'd like to, in part because of the organizational scheme, and that's tragic. So, Game of the Year 2021, glad to play it at the con. It was a great experience.
I'll talk about this because it's very similar. It is a game that ends prematurely and randomly and also is to do with blocking. I played Rise and Fall. This is designed by Christoph Bollinger and put out by Ludicolli.
Your French accent is glorious, Walker.
I'm very sorry.
I'm just joking. It's fine.
And I had this feeling before, but it sort of doubled down. And I'm not saying that, there's only certain ways to play Rise and Fall, but it seems to always fall into certain categories. Someone will start up a merchant strategy of acquiring a whole bunch of money, either merchant or a bunch of boats, and the other players have to end the game very quickly before that gets to cycle over and over again. So that was the sort of circumstance. I saw people getting merchants and another player getting boats. So I got a couple. I just focused on getting trophies and getting the game over sooner rather than later, which is too bad because the actual gameplay of blocking and moving around is super fun. But when you're like forced to end it before someone gets too out of control, I'm just not sure. Because I was hoping it would sort of eventually merge into, yeah, it's great to focus on certain things, but the person that does a bunch of everything will still get enough points. It just doesn't seem to work out that way.
I think it's one of those things where, not entirely unlike the so-called big money strategy in Dominion, the process of getting a large income from either ships or merchants or both is kind of straightforward. And for somebody who isn't very good at visualizing the blocking game or imagining circumstances of developing out into new unexplored area, either in terms of new kinds of workers or just in terms of geography, requires a little bit more imagination or skills that not every gamer has. So when I play Rise and Fall, I definitely feel the pull of the so-called big money strategy because it's straightforward and then you're just cycling. Now, it's a bit of a trap because it's somewhat difficult to make that truly remunerative, and it's also a little bit repetitive once you start cycling into that rhythm. But I imagine the intent, at least. I don't know. I don't know how successful it is. I haven't played Rise and Fall enough to know. The intent, at least, is to make it so that the time pressures and the various other pressures emerge, so that it's a delicate balancing act between those different kinds of strategies.
Yeah, maybe, because I have yet to buy temples. So I'm wondering, because the merchants were not in my areas, someone had unfortunately built a honeycomb of cities in order for the merchant to come in and capitalize on
that. Just squat there and tax like crazy, yeah.
Yeah, and so maybe I'm wondering if people focus more on temples, which lets you convert merchants to your side and maybe deter people from bringing merchants in, or like you said, block it out. Maybe that will like focus it more as a, you know, more equal type of game.
Well, that's exactly what happened the last time I played Rise and Fall. Huey saw me, I think, once or twice get a very successful merchant turn, partially off of his cities, and he just built a temple, and that was the end of that. And at that point, I was too bullheaded to switch strategies, so I just kind of doubled down and like, oh, well, that's only a minor impediment on my merchant income. I'll still be fine. I was not fine.
Also employed another interesting strategy that you can use in Rise and Fall, because when there's trophies, and the trophies you get are when you get all of a certain piece out on the board, then at the end of that round, people need to retire a card. The interesting part is that you can
fall in Rise and Fall.
Yes, that you can retire a card that you've already played that round, and then you can immediately buy it back. And stay in the round and then play that card again, because when you buy it back, it goes back into your hand.
I see. Okay.
So it's like I play all my, you know, I get the trophy because, you know, I played the city card. I retire the city card. I get the city card back. I play the city card again. And it seemed to work out. It was a very interesting way to sort of manipulate the table state. I very much enjoy Rise and Fall. And it just is amazing because it just looks so beautiful when it's on the table.
Many people commented that they were very disappointed that it was impossible to get now because of how impressive the table presence is.
Because even building the map is part of the game, and it's fun. You get these super thick tiles.
I don't know how fun it is. I mean, it's not...
Well, some people enjoy it.
It's not painful, but yeah.
So you put out the water, you put out grass, and then you put out forests, and then mountains on top of the forest, and then snow peaks on top of that, and it's this very three-dimensional, and all of the wooden pieces are screened on both sides. It looks fantastic.
Well, at least in the super deluxe version that you have.
True.
Finally for me, played Space Cadets Dice Duel. This is a game that I don't get to play nearly enough because this is a real-time, pretty quick madcap game with a fair number of rules. Now, that having been said, I did experience when explaining Space Cadets Dice Duel this time a little bit of the same phenomenon that I observed when teaching Race for the Galaxy. Namely, this is a game that I haven't explained in about 5 years at least, and I remember it being of a certain burden to teach the rules. And in both cases, after explaining the game after a prolonged pause, I then had occasion to reflect, oh, that's it? Because I can't help but feel that the average amount of complexity has kind of crept up, certainly in the Eurosphere. And so what we're willing to tolerate in terms of weird, thorny side cases and different kinds of card types and weird different effects has proliferated, for both good or ill. But I will say that the rules explanation was not as bad as I remember it being. That having been said, when it comes to real-time games, the barrier is a little bit different. The bar is lower because you can't be answering questions in the middle of play nearly as easily if the time pressure is pronounced. Given that Space Cadets Dice Duel is a two-team real-time game, the time pressure is pronounced. You're not operating against some sort of clock. You're operating against the fact that the other crew is trying to kill you. And so in this case, the ability to be able to take the time to help your crew members understand what their stations are is very much lower. Now, that having been said, in this particular case, that wasn't the primary burden. The primary burden that we had in this instance of Space Cadets Dice Duel were the following. Number one, my captain seemed as intent on chucking dice onto the floor as they were in terms of allocating them to the various stations so that they could do their job. Number two, the weapons officer seemed utterly indifferent towards any form of protection or loading torpedoes. Number three, the helmsman, who may or may not have been me, seemed primarily insistent on hurling abuse rather than support at the other team members. Now, which of these contributed the most to the fact that we were utterly and completely destroyed? I don't know.
Was this an instance of the other team just sort of sat back and watched your ship spiral out of control and
blow up? They were operating like a well-oiled machine. I wasn't privy to their discussion or how they did it, but the coordination was truly impressive. The game was ended when we were positioned on their flank. I had managed to maneuver us so that we were at point-blank range, so that simplified the weapons officer's job. And we were on their side. They were completely out of arc. They couldn't fire on us at all. I had already set up shields so that we had some shielding in all directions. And then I was there, again, possibly hurling what might be considered abuse at the weapons officer. I don't know. It wasn't my best moment, but whatever. It's okay. I was then sent out into the inky blackness of space without any oxygen as a consequence of their actions. So I feel like I'm the victim here. But anyway, and then suddenly, I look down, and in about 2 seconds, their helm operator gets their ship into our flank, and suddenly two torpedoes have been launched simultaneously immediately after this relocation. Now, I will then mention the fourth contributor to our ultimate demise, which is that the weapons operator, in addition to being very, very competent at loading and firing torpedoes, always managed to do the die roll that penetrated our shields. Because I will point out, in my defense, every time we got attacked...
Or lack thereof defense, because you're about to blow up.
Fair enough. Every time we got hit, the first torpedo encountered shields in the arc where we were attacked, in my defense. Now, the weapons operator managed to roll so that they didn't matter any time, but, you know, I'll take my victories where I can get them. So, this is one of those games where the rules explanation is almost as long as the game itself, sometimes even shorter, because, again, it's real-time. As I say, real-time games are a bit niche, but I really think that Space Cadets Dice Duel has aged rather well, especially since it's kind of aged into an environment where people are willing to shoulder more complicated games anyway, and real-time dice rolling is much, much more common now, and people seem to enjoy it. I'm a huge fan of Space Cadets Dice Duel. It was designed by Jeff Engelstein and Sidney Engelstein. I did actually some looking up to see what Sidney Engelstein has been up to, because I really like her design work. She's mostly been working on ANZ games, so not so much for us, which is a bit sad. So, this was published by Stronghold in 2013 originally, and Space Cadets Dice Duel is a great con-type experience game, and I'm very glad to have played it. Highly recommend it if you can get a chance to play.
Lastly for me, a listener was very nice to bring me a game called Outlive. This is my biggest regret of game that I gave away, designed by Gregory Oliver and put out by La Boîte de Jeu. Now, what Outlive is a post-apocalyptic sort of action selection rondel. You have your pawns and they rotate around this giant rondel, which is sort of like the city. And they have values from 3 to 5, a couple of 3s, a 4 and a 5. And if you put, and it's sort of counterintuitive, because almost in every other game, when a worker is not available, it's lying down. It is the opposite in this game. You sort of wake them up, they get up, and they move around, and they stay standing up. So if you move, say if there's a 3 standing up because they've already used that particular worker, and you move a 5 in, you're putting on pressure because you moved a higher worker into a lower worker, and they're both active, and they have to give you stuff or use bullets. So that's an interesting thing of workers being more powerful than others. The other interesting thing in Outlive is that you're not allowed to move. Your worker can move around the rondel 2 spaces, but you can't move to where you already have a worker. I'm calling them workers, but it's not worker placement. So it's this interesting of, I need to do this action where I already have a worker. that hasn't activated yet, so I must move that one out first. But it's a 3, and I don't want to move it right away because then he might get bullied. And so it's this interesting of what one do I need to move first and what do I need to get done right now? Because on top of that, there are limited resources that get populated every round. It's like, and you need to get to these spaces before everyone takes them all. And anyway, lots of interesting things. Cool weapons that you have to build and repair. You have to build your little base with an airlock to, you know, to keep out the radiation, and all these different buildings that have different abilities, and you have to populate them, and you have to feed all your people, and everything about it. I enjoyed it just as much as I did back then. Outlive is a great game.
Those are the games, some of the games.
Yes.
We played last
dozens
week.
Dozens of more. Dozens more.
And now for a brief break while we pay some bills. And we're back. Now on to the news and why it doesn't matter. No time for news. Let's just go on to talk about the con.
Yes.
News later.
First of all, I'd really like to thank Mark for organizing all this, taking the initiative, getting this done, finally making this dream of having a convention for us possible.
Well, thank you, Walker. Your assistance was absolutely invaluable, and you were a key part of the success. People don't come to Kingston for Mark. They come for the show, Walker.
It's true.
And we call Walker the show.
I very much also like to thank my wife, who made baked goods for people.
Oh, my goodness.
Set stuff up, had the coffee ready for people.
We could have charged, not that we were interested in being mercenary, we wanted to cover our costs, and we did. We could have charged, I think, 3 times as much, and people would not have complained because of the spread. This con had the best food of any gaming con ever, bar none. We charged for nothing. There was, what, 7 different kinds of baked goods from your wife that were all amazing. Those oat bars were deadly. Oh my goodness, those oat fudge bars. On top of that, you brought chips from Costco and granola bars and trail mix and bananas, and there was the coffee, and there was the water jugs, and we had pop in the fridge. It was, sorry, soda or soft drinks, depending on where you're coming from. We ate and drank like kings and queens and gender-neutral monarchs. It was wonderful.
And she wanted to make sure that, you know, that she not only enjoyed doing the baking, she just enjoyed being there. Everyone was so friendly. And then she said, you know, if people want, she has a Facebook page for her cooking, Chef Ashley.
I'll leave a link in the episode notes below.
Mark's going to put a link. And so if you want to thank her or go check out all the other stuff she does, you can go there. She does great meals and everything else. Go ahead and check it out. And I want to thank the volunteers. There was great listeners that showed up early.
Everyone wanted to know how they could help. People were willing to clean up the bathrooms, to haul garbage bags. It was amazing. So much hauling to do because we needed a library. We had all the games to take away. And the weather, this is a technical meteorological term. The weather in Kingston this weekend was gross.
Yes.
And yet people were more than happy to go into my basement and haul stuff away. Thank you so much. I am indebted to one listener in particular. He knows who he is. He helped both on the setup and the teardown. It was amazing. But everyone was so generous with their time and their efforts and energies. It was great.
Also want to thank the venue. It was there. There was no limitations. It was always open.
Yep.
There was no sort of weird, funky rules that let us do what we needed to do.
I had my concerns, right, because it had been so long since I'd done the tour. And, one listener in particular, one attendee comments, like, you know, you say it's like a church hall and you have certain ideas about what that is, like a basement somewhere. Like, no, we're talking 20-foot-tall windows. And my other big concern was whether the AC was going to hold up because, again, 20-foot-tall windows and gross weather. But I think the AC more than held up its end.
I never felt uncomfortable.
Yeah. One person actually, this is one of my regrets. I've got a section of regrets. One of them is somebody asked, you know, am I going to get chilly from the AC? Because sometimes they're, you know, especially during the summer, I actually need a sweater because the AC is cranked up too high. And I said, I don't think so. And I was wrong. And I felt terrible about it all weekend. Because, I mean, I wasn't chilly, but I was running around the entire time. But I guess if you're sitting in the wrong place or if you've got a different metabolism or whatever, you need some covering. Fortunately, this person had ignored my advice and had brought long sleeves.
Brought a sweater anyway.
Not a sweater, but they brought the long sleeves, and with the long sleeves, they said it was okay. So I guess that goes to show that in future instances, you should just cover your bases and say, do you think I might need a sweater? And say, better take one. But anyway. So yeah, no, the venue was great. The only thing that I would have changed about the venue is carpeting would have been nice, so as to keep the noise a little bit down. It was never bad, but I don't think it was ever ideal in terms of background noise. But whatever, cons get noisy.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you know, a million thanks to everyone who attended, everyone who volunteered, everyone who helped. We had marvelous swag as well, largely by virtue of Walker's efforts. We had the official swag pen and the swag notebook. We also have the official swag token, thanks to the kind efforts of a very, very generous listener, and that helped us play The Green Team Wins. Anyway, so I've got my regrets, briefly. Because I agree with you. Overall, I think it was a resemblance.
Yeah, I was trying to think of something negative to say. And everyone was always positive. There was never any... I did not hear any complaints about anything. There was nothing that was lost or you know, parking bad, or I can't find this, or I heard no complaints.
Yeah, I mean, same here. The problem being, of course, this is one of the things that I wish I'd... I wish I'd emphasized a little bit more that we had... how to get in touch with the external ombuds team, because it occurred to me only ex post facto that even if someone did have an interaction that they felt warranted some comment, that they might not feel comfortable, even if it wasn't about us, they wouldn't necessarily feel comfortable coming and talking to us. So I wish we did have an external ombuds team, and we still do. And if you want to get in touch with them, you absolutely should. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to set up some sort of after con survey, and then make more clear how to get in touch with them if anybody wants to report that. So that's one of my regrets, some sort of better anonymized version of feedback. Because, again, I don't think people are going to come and complain to us in hindsight. Another regret I have, as I say, I wish I could have handled the whole AC question better. There's some games I didn't get to play. I didn't get to play Guards of Atlantis 2. More on that later. I think I was the only person there who didn't get to play. I wanted to play Corporate America. I wanted to play Space Gits. I would have liked to have been able to play the Mario Kart variation of Gaslands that got set up and played. That was glorious. One listener asked if I could set up and teach and play Voidfall, and I wish I'd been able to do it, but I just couldn't. I would have destroyed me, and it would have taken the entire day. So I had to bail on that, and so I felt bad about that. I wish we had better lanyards. The name tags kept getting switched around. And given that we have such, you know, we met like 60 people over the course of the weekend, we started forgetting names, and the lanyards were always facing the wrong way. So I'm going to investigate better lanyard technology to try to deal with that. Recycling, it was a little spotty over the course of the weekend. I wish I'd handled that a little bit better. I got a whole bunch of recommendations for roguelite video games, and I didn't write them down, and so now I remember zero of them.
I did make notes when people said things that I want to remember.
I wiser my person phone, than I, yeah.
Put the note in, which mostly happened. I'll talk about that. Eric, go ahead.
Well, that was another thing. That was one of our policies that we circulated, and I was completely pleased. I asked people who were attending, look, if you want to take a picture, if you want to use a scoring app, you want to do whatever, yeah, absolutely take out your phone. But if you want to compose an email, read the news, do social media, try to do that either outside the venue or before or after the con. If the weather had been better, that would be an easier thing to ask, right? Someone could just step out. I did that a couple times. I step out to take a call or try to check up on something that was happening with respect to the event itself, because I just didn't want, you know. Again, it's about creating the environment, and phone use is contagious, and I wanted an environment where people would actually be playing games with each other rather than sitting around all.
Yeah, I didn't see that being as a problem.
Yeah, no, I didn't see it being a problem either.
I have mostly the same regrets as you, just too ambitious. You know, I made this list, here are the games that I'm bringing.
Yeah, I could have told you that at the outset, yeah.
Here are all these promises that I made of games I wanted to play. Like I said, I was going to bring He-Man. I said, you know, so many people wanted to play Rise and Fall, and people didn't get to play, and games I said I was going to run that, you know, I think from now on that it'll just be, I think the best way to do it is just, if you're going to say you're going to, people want to play a certain game, it has to be the first game of the day.
Yeah. Committing to one game a day, I think, as an organizer, is about as much as you can promise.
And that in the timing, right? Because and it has to be the first one, because otherwise, like, I should have been more aggressive, because a lot of times I would finish game and I would just wait because it's like, oh, these people want to play a certain game, so I'll just, you know, hold up for a bit and see if they get free, because I was finished a game, but everyone else was still playing, and I should have just kept cycling games after games, right, instead of waiting around, more aggressive, even, you know, because I clearly didn't play enough games.
I do get the sense, though, that by and large, people got to play what they wanted. and there were lots of people, you know, taking games from the library. I definitely taught more games than I played, because especially if I saw somebody sitting with, you know, For Science or Through the Desert, I taught Through the Desert, I think, three or four times over the course of the convention, so that's great. A lot of people got to be exposed to that. And I taught For Science a bunch of times, and I taught other games, like Shackleton Base. I didn't play, but I taught people Shackleton Base. There was, you know, a lot of people just exposing themselves to do games, which is great. And by and large, you know, the library represents the games that we like, and the games that we didn't like were on a different table, table that people took away, which was great. Actually, no, that's not even true. I got rid of a lot of good things. I gave away a complete copy of Anachrony. I gave away a complete set of Too Many Bones. I gave away tons of really good stuff on that table. But anyway, the library was definitely of very, very high quality overall. I do have some questions for you. What do you think the game of the con was, if you had to characterize?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Like I was saying earlier, I didn't see one game being played much more than all the rest.
This is a lie. This is what Walker would consider to be a joke. On day one, at the same time, there were four different games of Guards of Atlantis 2 going on.
Never heard of it.
At the same
time.
Sounds
awful.
I will point out that did not even exhaust the number of copies of Guards of Atlantis that were available. Now, it never repeated those heights of day one, but Guards of Atlantis 2 was played every day of the con. And so, no question about it, Guards was Guards was the game.
I did want to play it. I just feel as though there's people that there played it a lot, and having someone that doesn't play it a lot come in, and it just changed the day. I think it's just a game that you need to play a lot of, or else you're going to bring your team down. And
well, I share that.
I didn't want to be that guy.
I heard some great stories of, in particular, the 8-player game, the 4-on-4 game, where there were very experienced players as well as relatively new players. The new players pulled their weight and did some pretty impressive stuff. I heard great stories about the 2-lane map and someone breaking off and effectively cutting everyone up. Anyway, so a lot of great stories about a lot of great games of Guards of Atlantis 2. And I have a surprise game of the con. I wasn't expecting to be played very much at all, but it was being played all the time, and I taught it a bunch of times, and that's Crash Octopus.
It's true.
There were two copies at the con, one in the library, one that had been brought by a listener, and several times, both copies were in play. There was just a lot of Crash Octopus going on.
Well, I heard from a couple of listeners that it's impossible to get, and if you find someone that's selling it, it's going for a ridiculous price, so
that's
I can
what
see why
told.
Maybe that's why.
I've been told this by a couple of people that I've taught the game to, so...
Another regret I have, it came at near the end, or like practically while we're cleaning up, I saw this sort of like demolished pop case with "We Need a Teacher" written on it and sort of like propped up.
Yeah.
And then I remembered that one of the greatest things I remember from Shucks,
yes,
was the fact that at the opening of the gaming area, they would have these weights tied to balloons.
And like the color of the balloons. Balloon might indicate we have a spot available, yeah, or we need a teacher.
Exactly. We need more players. We need a teacher. And I said, why did I not do this?
See, I thought of it the day before the con amongst a million other things that I needed to do. And I said, I can't. And I do regret that as well. I did, like I say, if I ever saw anybody sitting down with a partially set up game and a rule book, and I did this at least a dozen times over the course of the 3 days, I said, do you need any help? Would you like me to teach you the game? And sometimes they said, no, we're good. But much of the time said, please do. And so, yeah, that's one of the reasons why I sound so hoarse, not just because I was at the con, but because I was teaching games almost the entire time. But I wanted people to be able to play what they wanted to play, and it just, people seemed to be, and it did seem to be the case that the people who wanted to just play games over and over with the same people were able to do that, but that the people who wanted to be able to play games with new people also did that too. Because, I might have a conception that as somebody who's, you know, nominally involved in a community that everyone should interact with everybody else, but not everyone wants to do that, right? And if you want to go to a con and you just want to play games, sometimes games even that you have at home or whatever, with the same person at the same table, that's cool. You get to do that. I want to empower you to have the experience that you want. One thing I definitely don't regret is, and it sounds stupid, but I actually think it paid dividends, was the emphasis on good vibes. Vibes are good. Someone's like, oh, I don't know. What if there's a... Good vibes. Yep. It's all good. Not a toxic positivity.
No.
Right? But like, don't sweat it. It's all good. Good vibes.
It will fix it.
Yeah.
The other thing I loved is the fact that I got the conversations in. We have a sort of hotel core that was near the venue, and there they had like a IHOP. So I, you know, told people every morning I would be there. So there's like a table of always like 10 to 15 people.
Oh, that's great. I'm sorry to have missed that.
And for like an hour and a half, we would just talk shop. That's where I made the notes. I want to make sure I say that. I did not pull my phone out.
I really regret not being able to do that. But every night I got to bed at midnight every night.
Yeah, I forced you to close, and then would have to
open up in the next morning. So it is what it is. I needed that extra time of just, you know, resting my voice and sleeping and being able to sluice the filth off me. Because again, I would like to remind you, the weather was gross.
Yes.
The barometric scale reading was gross. So that was absolutely necessary. Loved the play of Green Team Wins.
Went well.
Any surprise results?
Nope.
Oh, I was shocked that Cookie won over Pie.
Yeah, no, it's much like the Papa does, right? When you slander one choice over the other, people tend to choose the other. So, like I said, it worked out exactly the way I thought it would.
These are lies. Cookie won by the strength of its inherent goodness.
Of course it did.
How dare you? I just presented the question and the people answered. The people have spoken.
No, people that were there will differ, but
that is absolutely not true. Something I think we need to end on, though, really, is the greatest travesty. One of the rules was violated.
Oh my God. Mark, do tell.
One of the conditions of attending Congrès So Very Wrong About Games, Fun Times Good Vibes Only, Trans Rights or Human Rights Board Game Jamboree, was that every attendee was required to take something from our games.
I believe they signed a waiver that said they had to.
Well, in spirit. And I can attest that somebody has confessed to not having done this. And do you know what? It's the cruelest cut of all. Do you know who it was?
Who was that?
Warm Boy.
Oh, my God.
Warm Boy did not honor the terms of the agreement.
He's banned.
I don't know what to do. This is a grave challenge. It's a shock to our values. And after he reclaimed his name.
Exactly.
I was a little bit worried because, once again, we've said this a number of times, and yet people are still shocked. It is WARM. Warm, not worm. Of course, that's a valid differentiation some people don't have.
Not so fine. Warm when you validate the rules, though.
It's true. It's true.
It hurts my heart.
That was cold, Warm Boy.
Yeah, very cold.
Now he is Cold Boy. Thanks again for everyone who came. Sincerely grateful. It is. I'll talk more about this on Bloat, I think, but this job that we have can be very alienating. And it is endlessly rejuvenating to be able to encounter people who consume and possibly even appreciate what we do. And so that was the biggest value for me, I think.
Yeah, I think it'll definitely change the attitude of recording. I really do.
Yeah.
Like going forward, knowing an audience, right?
Absolutely.
As opposed to the blur that you think you're talking to.
Yeah, and the last time we were able to do this was years ago at Shucks. Yeah. So there you go. So thanks again, everyone. Hope those that that missed the con got some sense of what's going on. We have more pictures. We've got some video that we'll be uploading to various venues in due time.
Yeah, even on Ashley's chef page, he has a bunch of pictures of the con as well.
Absolutely. Again, link in the episode notes. Thank you so much to those that joined us, and thank you so much for joining us for this episode of So Very Wrong About Games. That's going to do it for this week. We do have a Patreon. This is an episode that is multiple of five, so please consider supporting free and independent media at patreon.com/svag. We've got tons of bonus content there, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of bonus content there, available for low, low price, as well as ad-free episodes and a whole bunch of other benefits. We hope to see you again soon. Take care of yourselves. Take care of your hobby. Thank you, Rules Explainer.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark McMahon. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.
Looking to get the most out of your money, time, and even better, your points and miles? I'm Chris Hutchins. I'm a lifelong optimizer, and I've sold two companies, racked up millions of points, and traveled the world to over 60 countries almost always for free. And I host All the Hacks, an award-winning podcast trusted by more than a million listeners that turns big ideas into quick tactical moves you can start using today to upgrade your life, money, and travel. Recent episodes have covered how to book business class seats for economy prices, prices, how to make an easy $3,000 a month from online deals, and tiny habits that you can use to buy back hours of your time each week. There's no fluff in the show. It's just proven playbooks to travel better, spend smarter, and design a life you're excited about. So search All the Hacks, that's All the Hacks, in your podcast app, hit follow, and start upgrading your life today.